netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Guide Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. And this week I'm joined by Jeff. John's actually on his way to Macworld. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, I'm good. Good, getting over a cold over the holidays and all that, but hanging in there.
Man, you've been working hard lately, Christmas notwithstanding.
Yeah, well, it works.
So we're going to be crossing soon to an interview that you recently did, but it's so nice to be able to talk to you. Let's have a chat before we cut to the interview.
Yeah, sure. This is I am jealous of John. This is Geek Week with CES and Macworld the same week, and John's on his way up to Macworld.
Having just repaired his X-Ray, which lost its power supply. But luckily didn't lose any of its data.
Oh, wow.
So we're looking forward to presumably an 8 proc or something at Macworld. That'll happen by the time this podcast gets broadcast. So I guess we shouldn't focus too much, as it'll be history by the time this goes to air.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have ordered stuff by then.
If it's an iPhone or if it's an IT TV or if it's an 8 proc machine, yes, I'll have ordered one by the time this goes to air.
Exactly. The whirlwind begins now. It's January, so that's the Macworld followed by NAB preparations and NAB and PhDs in full swing.
Yeah, PhD's going very well. We're actually only at week 2. It's a bit confusing for people because the term started in December, but actually only started for 1 week. We had a couple of weeks off for Christmas and also to allow people to do some image modeler special tutorials and challenges we did. So, in fact, we're only at the beginning of week 2, so it's actually a great time to join PhD if you want to pick up for this term. But
I'll put a plug. I've been checking out the Digital Color Theory course, which has just been outstanding. I've only gotten through the first 2. I think the third one came out today. But it's just a great class. It's just something I usually wouldn't expect, and it's very, very helpful. I like it so far. Looking forward to the rest of it.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? It's great, and there's some really brilliant stuff coming down the pipe, so we're looking forward to that. And in fact, right. I've got some people here this week who are doing prep for Term 4, so we've got a whole bunch of flame stuff coming in for Term 4, so it's all good.
Oh, that's great.
So one of the things that you've been busy doing is talking to the guys at Ascent Media and trying to work out what happens to material after the job is finished and when it disappears into the perpetual black hole of could you just archive that and I might need it in a year or two.
Yeah, exactly. We, in the world of feature films and TV shows, you know, we get a final on a shot or we finish the show and we tend to stop thinking about it. And I had a tip from a friend of ours who suggested that I talk to people over at the Digital Media Data Center in Burbank. Just told me that it was an amazing operation, that Ascent had really focused their energies on a facility to deal with that whole what happens after the show's done. Because, you know, take a sitcom. You know, it gets sold to how many countries and how many languages and how many versions and commercial insertions and how many deliveries. And, you know, that's just one TV series. So you multiply that by movies and all the different variations that have to be done by that. And it's quite an operation. And what I found fascinating, and we'll talk to Tyler Fleshney, who runs the operation out there, is just how large this facility is and also how it's got its feet so firmly in both worlds, both digital technology with big servers and big RAIDs and switches and stuff like that, but also there's a whole lot of the world that still takes this stuff on tape, especially TV shows and things around the world. So they've got like 4 or 5 of the largest tape rooms I've ever seen set up in a row, just churning out every format known to man for distribution. So it's quite interesting, and huge vaults. I mean, you'll see if you go to the website for the story that accompanies the podcast, there's, you know, the classic Indiana Jones shot of a vault with the just row after row. We weren't even allowed to get in the vault. Tyler, who was running up, who runs the place, his card wouldn't let him in the vault on the weekend, so we actually had to get a stock photo from them for that. But it's just amazing. Security is huge, obviously, at a place like this because of all the content floating around, so we talked a little bit about that.
There must be an enormous risk of fire or earthquake or something. I mean, what happens if, you just don't want to turn the sprinklers on in a digital facility.
No, that's very true, and I'm sure they thought about that because they've thought about so many aspects there. the building's really laid out well for workflow in terms of tapes flowing in and out and, you know, going on to servers and, you know, very lockers for the employees to put their stuff in because they can't bring personal items into the area where content exists. And the whole facility is very, it's 105,000 square feet. That's pretty huge.
Wow. You know, it's astonishing to think how valuable some of that stuff is. I mean, you only have to look at how long something like a Gilligan's Island was in reruns to get an idea on how the value is of syndicated programming. We're not talking about tens of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars or even $100,000. I mean, Seinfeld goes into syndication and it's worth, you know, millions. And
I mean, the room where the people that answer the phone and talk to the people who, you know, the teams of people who talk to the studios and stuff on these projects, is bigger than some facilities I've been in. And it's just a room full of people on phones taking orders. I mean, the place is just massive because you think about all the content that's created and all the different places and permutations it has to exist in. They do everything from cinema deliveries to, you know, putting the security into that to purposing video for iTunes and cell phones. I mean, they really have their, like I said, they're in so many worlds. They just really have it covered.
Wow, I've often wondered where somebody did the stuff for to get stuff on iTunes. And that's a good point you raise, just how many amazing variations there are now for the deliverables. You know, it isn't just the 16 by 9.
It all has to happen. I mean, we're on deadline, but once that show's finished, think about the deadlines then that exist. I mean, a movie. You know, when we finish the DI, for example, you know, boom, it has to hit theaters. Sometimes very, very short turnaround. So
yeah.
The amount of storage they have to have and data and, you know, just the systems you have to have in place when you're dealing with that kind of setup is what they really have focused on there.
And, of course, Ascent also has a huge commercials division, so it isn't just, I mean, it really is everything, isn't it? It's from TV commercials to film to TV shows to cinema release.
Yeah. I mean, Ascent has such a huge base of operations around the world that, you know, I'm sure a lot of the good majority of the shows that come through there started another Ascent facility,
So that's absolutely amazing. And, you know, I guess the thing is, as you said, the photos on the website really tell the story, don't they? You get that idea of those vast corridors, and it's just, do you get any idea from them how long the facility's going to be, have room to expand for them? Is it designed so that they're going to not need to touch it for another 5 years, or is this something that they're going to have to do all over again in another few years?
He said they just finished a major redo and seemed like they had room to expand. It's just huge. I mean, I can't describe the building. They were telling me that during the construction, they were joking that one of the hallways has to be the longest hallway in Burbank. And in fact, the fire inspector, when he came through, said, "You do know this is the longest hallway in Burbank." There's a picture of that on the webpage. I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, let's cross now to pick you up, actually recorded on location in Burbank.
Okay, so we just finished a tour of the Digital Media Data Center, and I'm here with Tyler. Let's talk about what we saw. Lots of diverse business opportunities here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a 105,000 square foot facility, so, you know, we had to pack it with everything that we had. I mentioned to you on the tour that we had in Burbank, four or five different facilities spread throughout town. We had a DVD business. We had a film mastering business, a language and subtitling business, and also duplication and standards conversion business, all spread out in different facilities. So the goal was to really try to find a place where we could bring all those together, share a common infrastructure, really focus on security, scalability, and prepare ourselves for the migration to the file-based world.
Cool. As a visual effects artist, my end date is usually the shot's finaled, so that goes off to somewhere and ends up on film, sometimes in a very short amount of time, and we tend to forget what happens after that. That, you know, the DI happens, obviously we know that, and it goes to film somehow, but then there's a multitude of things that happen. Can you talk about some of those things that would happen to media?
It's kind of funny because our two worlds are so adjacent, yet they seem to never collide, and we seem to never think about one another. I think if you walk through this building and asked anyone about the sort of the visual effects process or anything that's happening on the front end, they may look at you with a blank stare. There's a whole host of things that have to happen, you know, after the first showing, and then really through the life of the asset. You know, one of the things this building is focused on is not the short term, it's the long long term. What's going to happen with this feature? What's going to happen with this television show over the next 5, 10, even 15 years perhaps? So, you know, we're taking digital intermediates, we're taking high def masters, we're taking film elements out of libraries, and we're retransforming them. We're really remanufacturing them in sort of a custom manufacturing environment for its next life. So while you guys are, you know, creating the latest and greatest in visual effects world, we'll then take that image and lay back perhaps a new language, or take that master and transform it from a NTSC broadcast standard to a PAL broadcast standard, or we'll compress it and author it for a DVD. So we're really focused on sort of the long life cycle of the asset, and taking what you guys do at the front end and kind of trying to preserve it and monetize it over the long term.
So complete, I mean, everything that has to happen from delivering digital files to the theaters to DVD.
Digital cinema delivery. There are a couple companies out there that have really focused on actually delivering the files. What we'll actually do is actually prepare the files for delivery. So as an example, we did Pirates of the Caribbean actually this summer. The DI, the digital intermediate, was done at one of our sister facilities in our creative services group. The files then came over, and we did the color space transformation to the digital cinema spec XYZ color space. We also packaged those files, wrapped them securely, and then delivered them to one of the distributors that are out there. So we've elected from a strategic standpoint not to focus on the delivery, but we're going to remanufacture that image. We're going to transform that image and wrap it securely and deliver it to the ultimate distributor. And that's true of digital cinema, and is true of really almost any format. As I was walking throughout the building, we were looking at it was kind of a trip down memory lane as you could look at all the old formats that we've gotten. And the reason that is the case is that we're working on, like I said, library titles, and we have to handle something that may have been made 20, 25 years ago that's now, you know, had a resale, or they're going to bring it out on DVD. So we've got everything from the oldest 1-inch machines, 2-inch machines, all the way up to the latest, you know, Sony's HDCam SR machines. So, you know, it's a real challenge for us to make sure that we can, again, keep current, but at the same time not lose the historical fact that, you know, we're dealing with library titles that need to be, you know, sold over time. So duplication, standards conversion, compression and authoring, film scanning, recording, telecine, language reversioning, you know, these are all the services that are offered under this one roof.
Security, you mentioned that too, and I noticed in the whole facility there's a very good sense of security. I know, besides just key cards and things like that, you showed me the lockers where people have to lock up their personal items, and no portable devices can be plugged into the system for security reasons, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone knows the hot issue of piracy out there. I mean, you can't turn on a TV set anymore anytime a major movie's released and not hear that there were 30,000 DVDs sold in some Hong Kong market, or that some kid in Iowa's got a site that's got, you know, a movie being broadcast on it. So, yes, yeah, security is a real big concern for us here, and we've worked very closely with our customers, the studios themselves, and with the MPAA to really define a security paradigm that really is second to none in this industry. Not only the physical formats that we have, very easy to walk out with some of the smaller tape formats, a DV cam or a Beta SP, something like that, but also, and perhaps more seriously, are the file-based formats. So we've been very focused on restricting access to key areas, allowing only certain people the ability to move and manipulate a file in our system, and really sort of focusing people where they need to be focused, and again tightening that circle of who's handling the content, because you know, if one of these pieces of content gets out, if we found that something leaked from an Ascent Media facility, you know, the costs to us for both our reputation and monetarily are just too much to handle. So yeah, we've been really focused from building this building, you know, because we built it from scratch, we're actually able to weave that security into it from its inception.
You mentioned tape formats, and I was very impressed by the just row after row. I mean, take the largest facility you've been in and think of the tape room there, and then multiply it by, there's maybe 5 or 6 of those bays, and there's more tape machines than you would expect in a normal facility even there, and every format from 1-inch machines, which were quite the flashback.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, we talked about, and everyone likes to, well, and it's happening to some extent, but everyone likes to talk about the fact that we're in this digital world, that we're in this file-based and everything's moving around at the speed of light world. And we're getting there. You know, that's going to happen. It's starting to happen a little bit. But we still push a lot of tape. And again, because we're dealing with library titles, these are tapes that have been made over the course of the past 10, 15 years. And, you know, we're delivering almost every country that is broadcasting television content throughout the world. We have a strong syndication business that is doing commercial integration and duplication and sending that out either via file base or sometimes still via FedEx or other delivery systems to television broadcasters. So, yeah, we still push a lot of tape. You know, it's a logistical business. It's also, you know, a dying skill in some senses. I think as people start to grow up in this digital world, and you guys are all listening to this on podcasts, and, you know, it's all been filed from the get-go, you know, there's a lost art in manipulating film and tape. And you know, we've got 375 people in this building, many of whom are the best in the business at doing just that. And, you know, tape's death has been greatly exaggerated. We still are doing quite a bit.
Sure. But on the other hand, you also have a huge infrastructure. I saw how many terabytes of...
Yeah, we've got a significant investment, obviously, in the file-based world. I mean, I don't want you to get the wrong idea that I think that the future of the entertainment business is on film and tape. It's certainly going to be in an asset, file-based asset management world. And our big investment in this building has been our Atlas digital asset management system. We're working with the Sony Corporation right now and Sony Pictures Entertainment and ingesting all of their content into our digital asset management system. The key there is not only as a deep archive for sort of future use, but actually as a real transactional engine for them to take current content, have it transcoded and delivered to the real proliferation of platforms that we see out there, not only viewing platforms, but also file-based platforms, you know, new formats, cell phone, iPods, VOD, IPV, you know, HD, standard def, all of these now can be done in a virtual environment where we actually have an asset that is stored at a fairly high, what we'll call mezzanine level, and then can be transcoded to all of its future uses. So, yeah, I mean, that's the future of this business. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we have to keep... We have to keep a foot in both, you know, sure, kind of on both logs in the pond here because, you know, again, still moving tape, but at the same time, we have to kind of match that migration as some of our customers start to migrate from film and tape into this file-based world. And hopefully we can act as a guide for them and a guide through this forest of, hey, how do I even go from a tape-based world to a file-based world? There are so many different formats, bit rates, and, you know, hopefully we're acting as a guide in that. And again, that's our future.
Yeah, that's awesome. The one thing I just the sheer size of the facility and the different businesses represented under the same roof. You said I saw a large restoration area as well.
Yeah, that's to me a very personally very interesting part of the business. We in 2004 purchased a company called Cinetech in Valencia, California. They're probably the world leader in film preservation and restoration. They've done some, you know, Easy Rider, Wizard of Oz, you name it. You know, if you've seen restored content, you know, chances are that Cinetech had a hand in producing that. One of the businesses that they started right around the time when we were looking to acquire them was a still image restoration business. They said, hey, we're the world leaders in motion picture restoration. We should potentially be the leaders in still image restoration, too. We understand the nature of the image. We understand film. So we've embarked on a program to actually solicit museums, universities, foundations, studios themselves, actually, and get their still images, their photographs, their slides. We scan them on our flatbed scanners and then do either a full restoration of those images or what we'll just call a kind of a dirt cleanup where we just are delivering back an unaltered but clean file. To me, that's a real source of growth in the future. When you start to think about all the people out there that have images that are not studios, the universities, the foundations, all these people that now can bring this content that has been stored away in boxes and in the basement and in cans and bring it to life in an iLearning environment or, you know, on the web or make it available for other teachers. You know, that for us is a real area of growth. So Cinetech has been very successful working with the Andrew Mellon Foundation. We're working with the New York Modern Museum of Art and a couple other entities right now and have some real good traction in that space. And it's a big area for growth. And we were able to plug that into this building quite easily because this building was built to be modular. We can plug different businesses in. New workflows, old workflows come out, new ones come in.
I have to imagine in a mile radius of this building the amount of images that are sitting somewhere that they shouldn't be and need to be restored and preserved. And
yeah, I mean, we're really finding that even the most sophisticated content owners, the studios themselves in some cases, don't even really have a very good handle on what they have, where it is, the condition it's in, the last time it was used, is it an original, is it a copy? So we've actually engaged with one of the studios on a consultative level. We're in the middle of an engagement right now to go through and look at their entire store of content and say, okay, here is our recommendations for how you should preserve this. Here's our recommendations for how you should spend your money most wisely to make sure that it does last the next 100 years. So when I look at the studios, I think those guys actually know what they're doing. How about all these universities? How about all these corporations who generate thousands and millions of feet of content but don't even know it? They're a studio and they don't even know it. Now, if we can go be a guide for them to help them preserve and again, migrate into a digital world, that, again, to me is a huge opportunity.
Sure. It's funny. It's not unlike on a much larger scale, obviously, the problem facing consumers at home with digital photos and boxes of stills and, you know, how do you keep track of all that?
How do you organize it? What's the best format to keep it on?
Right.
You know, another thing we're seeing, we're working with another studio right now. You know, we sometimes used to joke that digital is 5 minutes or forever, whichever comes first, because we've seen, you know, some early adopters in the digital age save some of their content on what are now obsolescing formats. So we have, there's a format out there called DST that one of the studios has put a number of their titles on. Well, there are probably 3 or 4 DST players left in the world. So there's a real race here to kind of migrate that from a DST tape to an LTO2 or LTO3 tape that has a little more longevity, because once those players go, that content might as well be lost. So even in this digital world, you know, some of the early adopters are seeing that, hey, you know, I may have jumped too quickly, or even if you do jump, and look, there's no guarantee today that, you know, an LTO 2 or 3 tape will be read 50 years from now. I'm not a technician. I don't know that for a fact, but I do know that that I can hold a piece of film up to a light in 100 years and know that that's a title. So we're trying to kind of, like I said, kind of live in both worlds. You know, there's still value in a physical environment. There's still efficiency in a file-based environment, and how you marry those two together is going to be really, really critical for us.
Yeah, it's a huge concern for everybody. And I've actually heard of stories from years ago of a studio that restored a movie early on in the restoration process and actually vaulting the tape machines themselves, you know, vaulting not only tapes, but, you know, a couple of tape machines and computers that could work with them, and so that there was a working system no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that is probably the number one issue facing archivists right now is obsolescence of playback machines. And you take a format like quad, 2-inch quad, there just aren't enough machines around anymore. And unless you've vaulted them, and unless you've also vaulted the guy that knows how to work on him, so, you know, maybe you vault the tape and you cryogenically freeze the operator, because because that's a dying breed. You
Absolutely.
Know, I don't know too many people who can rebuild a 2-inch machine, or who can replace the heads, or who can actually get a stable image off of it. So,
and that was an art in its day. So,
exactly, you know, exactly. So if you lose, you not only lose the machine, but you're going to lose the mind sharing and the education side. So it's really something important to think about, and that's kind of what we're trying to push as the next step, and something we can do here is, yeah, we can make a tape, yeah, we can encode a file, but we can also provide some business solutions for you, too, around those issues. So, you know, that's going to be how we take this building to the next level in the future. You led off talking about the fact that sometimes people in the front end don't think about the back end or sort of what's happening when you repurpose. And I think that window is going to start to close more and more. I think the distance between us, if I'll say that, will become shorter and shorter as the way content is consumed and distributed changes. I think you'll start to see more people who are shooting on the front end really start to think immediately about, how am I going to repurpose this, or how is this going to play in Peoria, or how is this going to, you know, how am I going to get this in Germany? I think that, you know, historically, there's been a Chinese wall between the two, production and distribution. I think as we start to work on things like Final Cut Pro, and as we start to shoot in high def, and as some of these file-based, you know, image capture cameras like the DALSA Origin and the Genesis cameras start to take hold, I think producers are going to start thinking about the distribution arms themselves, and you know, I think those windows will start to collapse, and we'll start working perhaps more closely together. So I think technology may bring us a little closer together, and in turn get content to the consumer more quickly and more frequently.
Right. The podcast that I did right before this, most previously to this, was on the film Zodiac. David Fincher shot completely digitally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, data direct to disc, 444, archived immediately, and then worked on digitally and distributed, you know. So that whole paradigm shift makes those assets available to you quicker, makes the assets to the studio quicker, makes, you know, if they get databased properly immediately,
right.
And it just does really start to open up possibilities and shorten production schedules.
It does, and it does also fundamentally change what we can do. I mean, look, let's be honest, we made a business out of the fact that we had to process that film and transfer that film and master that film. Well, now all that's being done kind of real time, so it cuts a lot of sort of the meal out from us. So we need to figure out different ways to actually stay engaged in that process and to continue to, you know, drive our business forward, even though some of the quote inefficiencies have been removed due to technology. So again, some of the things I was just talking about before with the consulting approach or looking at new content owners for business, you know, that's how we need to stay relevant, because, you know, we like processing film. You know, we like moving tapes. We like making dubs. You know, that's good for our business. And if production starts to go born on digital, stay on digital, you know, that cuts out a big piece of the pie for us, and we need to stay relevant. So
right.
That's going to be a challenge.
But there'll just be more distribution. There'll be
more
iTunes,
distribution,
there'll be
more transcoding, more reversioning, more long-term, you know, digital asset management opportunities. So, right, you know, we just need to evolve with the market as much as you guys do on the front end. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Jeff.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, it was great. It was actually kind of fun to go out and see the place in person and set up the FX Guide portable podcast system. I guess we have three of those now for setting up to record around the area. I hope to do some more of those.
I'll tell you a funny story. We're recording in France, and I said, oh, let's record on the train. That'll be fun. So we're recording on the train, and John starts to get embarrassed as French people get in and off the train and wondering why we're standing there with mics and in our ears on this moving train, right, and recording.
Honestly, so, I heard that one, I think.
So he starts getting softer and softer because he's just embarrassed to be – but I don't care, right? I'm an Australian. What do I care, right? Like, I'm standing there bellowing out. And when you go to the podcast, it's like, my levels are a little low, aren't they? It's like sometimes you have to be embarrassed for your art.
Yeah.
So look, what are you up to there? It's what day of the week is it? It's Monday there, is it?
Monday, yep.
Okay, and so tomorrow's
off
the
today, it's a little scheduling thing, but taking the day off, so
excellent. All
beautiful
right.
Day here.
Well, you look after yourself, and we'll catch up again soon, and thank you so much for that.
Oh wait, didn't you want to talk to somebody there's something you want to mention about the last podcast we did?
Oh, terrific point, man. I'm so glad you said that. Yeah, look, we we need to send an apology to David Vickery at Double Negative because due to an accent problem, we had him down as David Hickory, and that's Vickery. Now, of course, we've got three accents. We had the English accent, the Australian accent, and the American accent. It's astonishing that doesn't happen more often. But anyway,
yeah.
David was you know, incredibly kind, and we have corrected our mistake. But just for the record, it's David Vickery at Double Negative and Tim Webster at Framesource CFC that we were talking to last week. And I really do apologize for getting that wrong. It's a tremendous faux pas.
Yeah.
And thanks for reminding me, because I'd have been triply embarrassed had I not forgotten to apologize.
Yeah, no problem. I remember we chatted about that, the iChat. I don't know how we survived before iChat.
Oh, yeah, so true. Between Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. And the thing is that there's so much work being done with stuff behind the scenes, and there's a huge team of people that contribute. So,
I said earlier in the podcast that one of our friends suggested that we go out and talk to these guys at the Digital Media Center, and I'd remind people that, you know, if you have a story idea, give us a call, or, you know, send us an email, whatever. Get in touch with us, because we're looking for these kind of things. We're looking for stories.
Yeah, and there is some really amazing stuff that happens. Hopefully we're going to have a story coming up that was some sort of independent research done on the basis of a couple of podcasts that we did. And I know one of the guys involved, and he actually – I sent him an email saying, oh, this looks really interesting. And he said, yeah, well, I got the idea by listening to the FX Guide podcast when you guys were speaking to one of the film production companies. So we're going to follow up with him and see – that'll probably be a tip that will appear on FX Guide sometime in the next couple of weeks. So it is good. It's good to know people listen.
The,
Sorry, Jeff?
Just correct me up the ancillary uses.
Oh, yeah.
Of FX Guide. Remember the guy who contacted us about the using the camera solving technique tip on FX Guide that Peter Webb did for a criminal case?
Yeah, for a forensic court case. And we thought that was terribly...
Yeah, I was fascinated by that.
Spend so much time watching CSI and stuff to actually think that they would actually reference FX Guide for a real court case. It was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
So we really do encourage you to hit the forums at FX Guide and to email us and stuff because, you know, we love hearing from – we say that a lot, and a few people do contact us, but we constantly coming across people who say, oh, man, I listened to the podcast. It's really cool. Or I listened to it and I think you suck. No. We have less of that. But, so we would love to hear from you. And as Jeff says, ideas are always welcome because, you know, we like covering stuff from all over the world. And we have stuff coming up on films out of Spain, and we have stuff coming out of China and stuff. So we are trying to keep a fairly wide perspective here. I guess the thing, and it's true, isn't it, Jeff, the thing that we're trying to do is to be generating original content on these podcasts rather than doing just a bunch of guys sitting around discussing an RSS feed. Because... Well, those podcasts are good.
It's true. And, you know, we don't want to chase the most recent releases. Oftentimes we are able to tie in, you know, to a recent release because it just makes it more timely, but then also because there's just new technologies that people want to talk about. But that's not our thing. We're kind of, it's always been kind of what interests us probably interests other people. So we thought, let's kind of do this. And I think we're still kind of following that motto.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so hard to find a place where a professional in the industry can learn some of the latest techniques, and that's why we certainly started FX Guide back in the day. When I think you or I suggested doing I think I was going to do a frequently asked questions, and you were already doing one.
I was doing tips, and you were doing frequently asked questions.
There you go.
Somehow it came together. And
we heard of this guy in Chicago that was interested in doing stuff as well, so... We thought we'd contact him.
It's amazing how it has evolved and how the spinoffs like PhD and the podcast and all the different...
Oh, the live events as well. The live events have been amazing.
So yeah. Yeah. This is great.
We're definitely looking forward to doing some big stuff in Vegas this year. That'll be fun. And we've got some great people lined up and some fun stuff happening. We'll be doing the Sammy Davis and Dean suite again and recording studio. Always a blast. The fact that we nearly got thrown out of Caesars by security on that third visit on that large party 2 years ago still is one of my most proudest moments What was that?
I guess it doesn't take anything to surprise. It must take a lot to surprise the door people at Caesars because we truck in there with microphones and lights and cameras and, God knows what they think we're doing in there, but we pretty much take over the suite and set it up, and it's all, set up as a recording studio for a few days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Someone said, man, they must be thinking you're making porn in here. I said, have you seen us? There's no way that we're making porn.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough of the back-in-the-day discussion. It's been fun. Hopefully... John is finding his own parties in San Francisco. Jeff, it's been great talking to you, man. I'll see you in February when I'm over.
Yes, looking forward to that.
And that's it from us here at FX Guide. As always, we said, contact us on the web. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.